I hope that this presentation will serve to give to you a better knowledge and a deeper understanding of your FBI. FBI. Your FBI. FBI.
The FBI has engaged in an orchestrated campaign of unprecedented surveillance, grand jury subpoenas to environmental activists, conducting large-scale roundups of activists, levying unprecedented charges and penalties for property crimes. We've also seen the use of threats of severe sanctions to leverage fear in these individuals of conviction, which then forces in these people's minds the choice to turn into government informants.
We are as close to you as your telephone.
We've dubbed this witch hunt the Green Scare, obviously, as you've heard from other speakers, hearkening to the 1950s and the Red Scare. During the Red Scare, the word was communist, and it didn't really matter whether you were one or not. If they labeled you that, ramifications flowed from that. In this, the modern era, the Green Scare, the term is eco-terrorist. And again, it doesn't matter whether you are or you're not. If they label you as that, there are ramifications. The difference between the Red Scare and the Green Scare is, in this circumstance, the roundup is of environmentalists or anarchists. And the government has chosen to target these particular groups because they are on the fringe, because some of their views are radical. Their views are sometimes clearly not in accord with the government's views, and this has resulted in the Justice Department engaging in runaway prosecutions, and trumped-up charges based on what's clearly becoming evidence as a political agenda. Local police, FBI, and other federal agents have infiltrated meetings, public meetings. They've taken pictures of lawful protesters at lawful demonstrations. They've asked employers, neighbors, and fellow citizens about individuals expressing political views that used to be protected by the First Amendment. They continue to gain vast resources to execute these searches and these programs from federal coffers that were intended to fight terrorism.
FBI, get your hands up!
The FBI. Fidelity. Bravery. And integrity. The world is today witnessing a giant ideological battle, a battle for the hearts, minds, and souls of men, women, and children. This is the danger which we face today.
On December 7th, 2005, one of the largest roundups of environmental and animal liberation activists in the history of the United States began. Using codename Operation Backfire, the FBI arrested 7 people in 4 states initially. Chelsea Gerlach, William Rogers, Kendall Tankersley, Kevin Tubbs, Daniel McGowan, and Stanislaus Meyerhoff were arrested for allegedly taking part in a wide variety of actions the government is attributing to the ELF and ALF, Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front. The chart that I have up on the screen right now is the United States sentencing guidelines from their own website. You'll see that the average sentence for arson in the federal system is 5 years. Murder, 247.5 months, and some of these other really, really serious charges, you know, they're giving you some average amounts of jail time that these types of crimes warrant across the United States. Well, in these cases, the people are alleged to have committed property damage, not murder, arson. You know, if you want to call it that, call it arson. The burning of property. And as you can see, approximately 5 years is the average sentence. Well, these people are looking at life plus, at the maximum, life plus 1,115 years in prison for alleged crimes of arson. You don't see those numbers anywhere on this little chart, of course. Okay, so this is the original indictment that was issued back in January of 2006. That indictment basically it was as a result of numerous grand juries and basically was as the result of a single informant. This individual, Jacob Ferguson, voluntarily went to the FBI and asked for a large sum of money in exchange for information. He was a known serial arsonist and a known heroin addict who needed some money. And although he has admitted to being one of the leaders and has admitted responsibility for approximately 12 arsons, he walks free today on the streets of Eugene, while others that he has accused remain in jail. So within days of the first arrests, during the detention hearings, it became clear that Jacob Ferguson was the precipitating factor in these cases and that he was the sole basis relied on by the federal government for these cases. January 20th, 2006, Attorney General Gonzalez, the head attorney of our nation, gets up in front of the White House and makes a press statement where he accuses citizens who are innocent until proven guilty of being eco-terrorists. And his basis for this is the single informant, Jake Ferguson. The other thing to realize that these cases all occurred between 1996 and 2001, prior to 9/11, and the statute of limitations for many of these crimes, the earlier of them, were about to expire. They had no leads, no suspects, nothing to work with until Mr. Ferguson came forward. Yesterday, a grand jury in the District of Oregon returned an indictment charging 11 members of a Portland-based cell of animal rights and environmental extremists for their roles in a pattern of domestic terrorism activities. The 65-count indictment includes numerous charges of arson, attempted arson, conspiracy to commit arson, use and possession of a destructive device, and destruction of an energy facility. The indictment tells a story of 4.5 years of arson, vandalism, violence, and destruction claimed to have been executed on behalf of the ALF and ELF, extremist movements known to support acts of domestic terrorism. And then he thanks the U.S. Attorney's Office for doing their great job at keeping America safe. Within a few days of this roundup of arrests, Stan Meyerhoff, another one of the defendants, became confidential source number two. And from there, things began to snowball for these cases. Most of the people that are charged in these cases were between the ages of 18 and 24 at the time that they committed these alleged crimes. On December 22nd, William Rogers, one of the named defendants at the time, was found dead in his jail cell in Flagstaff, Arizona, from an apparent suicide. At first, those arrested were indicted separately, and each had their own indictment and their own trial, basically. And soon after, the government, at the highest levels of Washington, D.C. and the U.S. Attorney's Office, chose to consolidate all of these different actions into one large conspiracy. And they claimed that the family was a cell of people who all got together and did these crimes. But many of the defendants don't even know each other at all, have never met, et cetera, et cetera. And as Andrew mentioned, even though individual defendants are only being accused of one arson or two arsons, they are being held responsible through the conspiracy charges for the actions that span, you know, this entire 8-year time period, 20 different incidents, and 17 different defendants. And that's just the defendants, because there are other unindicted co-conspirators that will soon become public that just became informants right off the bat. As soon as the feds showed up at their door and said, you can do this the easy way or the hard way, they chose the easy way and became informants right away and have been working off their impending doom at the result of other people who are now looking at life in prison. So the crimes alleged arson, attempted arson, destruction of an energy facility, which was the toppling of a Bonneville Power Administration tower, that's the energy facility, what we're calling the hammer, which is a statute called 924C, It is the using and carrying a destructive device in relation to a crime of violence. This charge carries with it a 30-year mandatory minimum. And if you are alleged to have been accused of two or more of them, it's mandatory life in prison, which is why almost all of the defendants are looking at life in prison for these crimes. It's important to remember that none of the defendants in this case are charged with any form of terrorism. The word does not appear in this 65-count indictment at all, although the feds have, you know, obviously used it in their PR. They have not actually charged them with the crime. Here is the current second superseding indictment. They've added a few people onto it by this time. Nathan Locke and Joanna Zucker were arrested as a result of one of the cooperating defendants, basically ratting them out or giving their names. As often happens when you have a bunch of informants, eventually they run out of people and they start looking around and grabbing whoever they possibly could. And this is a pretty classic example of that going on. So February 23rd, those two were arrested and have been charged in the Romania Jefferson Poplar incidents. They're facing life plus 1,115 years in jail. On March 15th of this year, the government released yet another superseding indictment. And right now, the 65-count indictment is set for trial in the United States District of Oregon in Eugene for October 31st. A week later, on March 21st, 2006, the Vail indictment came down regarding the Vail resort fire, and in that, Chelsea Gerlach, Stan Meyerhoff, Josephine Overrigger, and Rebecca Rubin were named as defendants in that case. On March 30th, in Tacoma, Washington, Breonna Waters was arrested and indicted for the University of Washington horticulture arson. Her arrest is based on the work of unindicted co-conspirators, women who have made it public that they're cooperating with the federal government in hopes of reducing their own jail sentences. Waters is a violin teacher. She's got a baby that's about 6 months old. She has ardently defended her innocence in these charges, but she's looking at 45 years in prison, and according to the indictment, her crime is holding a walkie-talkie as a lookout. Then on April 6th in Sacramento, California, another indictment was handed down for a Susanville, California action, which was the arson of a BLM horse corral. Many of you may not know on this side of the country that our federal government rounds up the last of our wild Mustangs from public lands and sells them off at auction to slaughter to become dog food so that ranchers can graze cattle. We've been seeing extensive grand juries in this case. We think that there are approximately 60 to 75 people total that have been subpoenaed to grand juries in the greater Green Scare indictments. The grand juries, you know, unlike police, for those that don't know, have unlimited investigative powers. They can command your appearance, they can force you to testify. You don't have any First Amendment rights, and once they grant you immunity, you have no Fifth Amendment rights either. We have one individual, Jeff Hogue, that's currently in the Lane County Jail for refusing to cooperate with a grand jury. He's being held in contempt of court. He's a full-time nursing student. He's an environmental activist from our community, and he's looking at potentially spending up to 18 months in jail for never having committed a crime. No one is accusing him of ever committing a crime, but the government contacted him in the parking lot of his community college and told him that they wanted him to testify at trial, and they wanted to know what he was going to say before they put him on the stand, which is pretty standard for federal prosecutions. He wasn't about to cooperate with that, and so they said, well, we'll just grand jury subpoena you then and force you to tell us. This is an unlawful use of the grand jury. Grand juries are to come up with new defendants not to prepare their case for trial. And there's an ongoing challenge of this unlawful, overbroad use of the grand jury. There have been a lot of other folks that have been grand jury subpoenaed over the last few years, but Jeff Hoag is the only one so far that we know of that has gone to jail in lieu of being coerced by the federal government to give up what many people have as strongly held beliefs in non-cooperation with the government. And the National Lawyers Guild actually came out with a grand jury primer many years ago that I love to quote when I do grand jury trainings, and it says, "For many political activists, the historic and principled way to avoid the dilemma of perjury or informing has been the invocation of absolute non-collaboration with grand jury investigations of political movements. While this has resulted in many instances with the witnesses' incarceration for contempt, it has also discouraged the subpoenaing of further witnesses and on some occasions the withdrawal of all subpoenas." The other major point of this case is the government's use of informants. And if you think you have very few rights with regard to grand juries and whatnot, you have just about no rights whatsoever when it comes to informants. The government obviously doesn't have to tell you that they are surveilling you with an informant. There are very, very few statistics on informants, but we know that they have been used extensively. And, you know, the discussion on conspiracy, all the government needs in order to indict someone and convict someone of conspiracy is one other person to say that you were part of that conspiracy. And often that person is going to be an informant that is either being paid money for their cooperation or is getting their own ass out of trouble by putting the pressure on you or someone else. The government's case in this instance does not contain DNA, doesn't contain fingerprints, didn't contain confessions until people started rolling. There wasn't any real evidence linking any of the defendants to any of the crimes. And like I mentioned, without the information initially provided by Ferguson, there would be no federal case right now. If these acts were not political in nature, the suspects would be facing, like I said, 5 to 10 years in prison. But because the government knew that they could never rely on a heroin addict fellow co-conspirator as their sole witness at trial, right from the get-go, they had a plan. And that plan was to force informant coercion from the get-go. And so they overcharged these people incredibly. Not only did they charge a single count of arson for every vehicle or every building that happened to be a part of the incidents, but they charged that 30-year mandatory minimum, conspiracies, it's a 65-page indictment, like I mentioned, and a thousand plus years in jail. Many of the defendants are still in custody, and others had to pay exorbitant bail to get out of jail. The FBI announced about a year and a half ago that the ELF was their number one priority with regard to domestic terrorism. And I've always kind of thought that the FBI, you know, thought it was easier to go after bunny huggers who don't carry guns than to actually fight real crime that might be a threat to our physical safety. I mentioned to you that Gonzalez did his big press conference. That press conference occurred on the morning that the Aberhoff lobbying scandal was to start, and at the time when Scooter Libby began pointing the finger at Bush and Cheney for the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame, because her and her husband were critical of the federal administration. Many have suggested that the timing is not a coincidence in these cases, that a lovely smokescreen was put up and a scandalous distraction was put to the public in order to kind of appease you into not focusing on major, impactful federal crimes that are going on within our own government at the time. The other theory that's kind of been bandied about is, you know, since 1999 and the WTO protests, global protest has become very, very effective. And the corporations who are at the short end of the stick often were pissed that mass uprisings were occurring by normal people in places like Seattle and other places. And so they put their bazillions of dollars to work in groups such as ALEC, which is a legislative exchange group made up of Monsanto, Exxon, Halliburton, and all these other major scary corporations. They drafted model legislation like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and began to sell it around to all their cronies in various states because they didn't like the fact that us grassroots mere citizens were challenging their power and their grip on power. So that's kind of, you know, where we're at right now as far as the Oregon indictments. But the Oregon indictments were not the first and not going to be the last either. In May of 05, John Lewis of the FBI stated, he was talking about the need to expand the legislative front, and he states, quote, "Investigating and preventing animal rights extremism and eco-terrorism is one of the FBI's highest domestic terrorist priorities." But there's no mention of any right-wing groups as being a threat to our safety, like the KKK, like the abortion doctor killers, and many other more violent crimes. Those seem to not really garner any muster with the federal government right now. In January of 06, FBI agent David Picard told CBS News, "One of our major domestic terrorism programs is the ALF, ELF, and anarchist movement, and it's a national program for the FBI." The FBI admitted that it is again investigating an entire ideology as if it constitutes a security threat or a crime. You know, anarchism, for those that aren't, you know, aware, obviously has been around forever and, you know, has been a political philosophy or ideology and has been often targeted by the government because it has as a belief that, you know, we can rule ourselves better than having Big Brother rule us. Big Brother doesn't like that too much, and they have fought, you know, throughout the history of our country to suppress that ideology. In March of this year, FBI agent Rasner stated that food not bombs, and are most people familiar with food not bombs? They give food to the homeless. Food not bombs, indie media, which that's the independent media stuff that's on the internet, and anarchists are all on the FBI and terrorist watch list now. It's very, very dangerous to feed the homeless. If you do it, you are basically the same as Al-Qaeda, according to our federal government. Other Green Scare cases, you know, probably the first of them was the case of Trey Arrow. I don't know if folks out here were familiar with Trey Arrow, but he sat on a window ledge outside his governor's office and was trying to protect old growth forests. He doesn't wear shoes. He's a very ideological hippie boy who has a very devout, nonviolent, you know, ideology. He's been charged with 2 counts of arson and 2 counts of the 924 charge. He's currently in custody in British Columbia on Vancouver Island awaiting extradition. And he has conducted several hunger strikes because he's not being provided a vegan diet. The feds claim that he is a cult leader. Rod Coronado is also facing sentencing for interrupting a hunt, a hunt of cougars. And in February 22nd, 2006, he was charged in federal court in San Diego with a 1-count indictment, charging a felony charge of demonstrating the use of a destructive device. And what this was about is Coronado was asked to speak and somebody asked a question about an incident that he was already convicted of and had already spent 5 years in prison. And the question was something about, like, what did you do or something? And he kind of picked up a water bottle, well, it was a milk jug, and made some kind of, like, oh, this is what I did, you know, type of thing. That is now apparently a federal crime to speak of such things in public. And he is going to trial on that charge. There was another case, kind of an interesting one, the Sacramento 3, it's called. This was a case where an 18-year-old woman was recruited by the FBI to become an infiltrator and an agitator. She posed as a medic. She infiltrated herself into a very young group of anarchists. She agitated them into more and more levels of action, let's say, and you know, threw temper tantrums when things weren't moving as fast as she would like. She also went to major globalization protests and posed as media, as well as a medic. One of the women in that case, Lauren Weiner, has joined the dark side and has pled guilty to a conspiracy charge. And I wanted to show you what the plea agreement looked like, because in federal court they always have written plea agreements. All of these cases are being centered out of Washington, D.C., so this plea agreement is going to be really similar to all the others that we're going to see coming out. Page 4 is kind of the most outrageous, which is her agreement to cooperate. Basically, she's over a barrel for the rest of her life. Whenever the feds want anything from her, they can come to her, and she's under an obligation to cooperate with them. If she even sneezes in the wrong direction, they can revoke this deal and give her no plea deal, and she would have to go to trial even after having admitted fully on tape and in writing to the federal government her role in these crimes. Now, of course, the feds write these things up and tell these people, you know, here's what you did, right? And, you know, most of the time, because they were looking at 40 years and are now looking at 5, they'll do just about anything the feds tell them to do. The other important thing about this plea agreement and what we're going to see coming down, unfortunately, with others, is that they're being asked to plead to conspiracy. You know, in our cases, in the Oregon cases, they're basically accused of arson, you know, setting a fire. But what we're going to end up seeing is most of them pleading to conspiracy. And there's some theories of why this is, but I mean, my personal view is the government really wants to be able to say that all these groups, environmental, anarchist, you know, Middle Eastern, anti-war, they're all really one big thing and they're out to overthrow the government. And this conspiracy that they're alleging is a ridiculous one. It's not based in fact at all, but because the feds are giving them one offer and one offer only, and because conspiracy carries with it 5 years and arson carries with it 5 years, people are going to be pleading out to that. And this plea agreement is really Orwellian, and it's on our website if you want to look at it a little bit closely. The affidavit that was used in this case to secure arrest warrants used the term anarchist or anarchism 26 times in a 14-page indictment. They seem to be really obsessed with anarchist lifestyle, literature, dumpster diving, and other things like that. Basically, the FBI has named a group of people as their number one target who have never been known to carry weapons and have never committed an act of violence or harm to a human being. There were no deaths or injuries in the acts, the FBI is alleging. And while arson is a serious charge, it's always important to draw a line between the destruction of property and the destruction of life. It's also important to remember that one of the men accused of the Oklahoma City bombing, Michael Fortier, was recently released after serving less than 10 years in prison for killing 129 humans. These people are looking at 1,000 years in prison for burning down a building. The 2,900 deaths that resulted in the World Trade Center incident, you know, that is kind of what we're using as the benchmark for what terrorism really is. And then, of course, people are entitled to the presumption of innocence until proven guilty at trial. The feds, you know, are basically doing away with these people's ability to have a fair trial. It will be very, very difficult for them to find jurors that have not been brainwashed by the government PR spin that's been pumped out of Washington, D.C. And this is not the first time that the FBI has unfairly targeted environmental activists. The Judy Berry case, she was a labor activist, environmental activist, who was blown up in her car, and the feds accused her of carrying bombs and blowing herself up. 10 years later, in a civil suit, she won $4.1 million from the FBI because she did not blow herself up, and in fact, there was a police and FBI conspiracy to do so. The FBI is currently defining eco-terrorism as the use or threatened use of violence of a criminal nature against innocent victims or property by an environmentally oriented subnational group for environmental political reasons or aimed at an audience beyond the target, often of a symbolic nature. This definition of terrorism criminalizes holding a banner, marching in the street, throwing a rock through a window. All of those petty vandalism crimes now fall within the gamut of terrorism under these definitions. We have to take back power of words and of the law. We have to control the language. That is very, very important. We have to question what the government is pumping out in its PR spin and look at the facts. They are available on the internet more widely than ever before, and we really need to be challenging these words and the propaganda and the pushing of a political agenda that will result in people, human beings, serving the rest of their lives in jail.